This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yisu Heap. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Zambia's parliament has suspended 48 opposition lawmakers for boycotting a speech by the president earlier this year. A sign of mounting tensions as the jailed opposition leader awaits trial on a treason charge.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details next.
Also, Nigeria's acting president warns against any violence directed at ethnic Igbos. Gambia's president Adama Barrow vows to restore press freedom. And Tunisia is extending its state of emergency for another 4 months.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, following threats by some northern youth groups against ethnic Igbos, Nigeria's acting president is warning against any violence. Yemi Osinbajo says anyone who damages lives or property will face the full wrath of the law. The acting president is meeting with political, religious, and traditional leaders of northern states after youth groups have gave Igbos 3 months to leave the north. The Igbos are mostly Christian, while the population in northern Nigeria is mostly Muslim. Tensions have increased as groups in the Igbo-dominated southeast again call for a separate, independent state of Biafra. 50 years ago, 1 million people died in a civil war as Biafra tried and failed to win independence from Nigeria.
It has almost been 6 months since former Gambian president Yahya Jammeh fled to Equatorial Guinea after refusing to concede defeat in a 2016 election. During his 2 decades in power, Jammeh was accused of abuses, including attacks and restrictions on journalists. The new government of President Adama Barrow has vowed to restore press freedom, and changes already are evident. Sophia Christensen reports from Banjul.
It is quiet at Taranga FM. Nothing is airing. The power has been cut for 48 hours, and the generator has run out of fuel. But this popular community radio station is used to challenges. In 2008, Taranga FM started broadcasting local press reviews in Wolof, Mandinka, and Fula languages. That did not go down well with the government of former President Yahya Jammeh. Biram S. Jobe is the assistant director of Taranga FM.
The radio was shut down 5 times. Yeah, it was shut down by the government for 5 times, and the final one was in January 2017. But what we can attribute the closure might be, they say that it is a threat to national security, according to them.
But things have been looking up for Taranga FM, at least when there is power.
Taranga FM. Mokki.
A media renaissance is underway in Gambia. The Public Utilities Regulatory Authority is processing 30 applications for new radio stations, and many existing broadcasters are adding shows in local languages. Star FM launched Gambia Kacha, meaning to chat in Mandinka. Presenter Usman Trawali.
It's basically on politics, you know, discourse about politics, discourse about current affairs and things affecting people right here in the Gambia, which you cannot do before during the Jammeh regime, because Jammeh restricted the media and personnel of discussing his affairs.
The new government has been reaching out to journalists. Since his appointment in February, the Minister of Information, Demba Ali Jawo, has personally visited newspaper offices. He also shared his contact details in a letter to online media platforms. Talibe Hidara is assistant editor of the Standard newspaper.
Now I can pick a phone and call somebody at the Minister of Information, maybe the Permanent Secretary or something, and say, okay, I need something, this and this and that. The person might not be able to give me all that I want, but at least it's a difference, a big difference from before. Then you dare not.
The Standard newspaper recently doubled the number of copies distributed to street vendors each day to meet rising demand. At a local newsstand in Manjul, George Jezurobo clutches his copies of The Point, Daily Observer, The Standard and The Voice, 4 of the 5 independent newspapers in Gambia. He says he enjoys comparing different views.
Before, I hardly buy papers because I believe that what is going to be reported is what already plans ahead. But this time, I buy paper because the government are not interfering in the...
But journalists and rights groups say there is still a way to go. The Gambian Press Union says laws criminalizing sedition, defamation, and the publication of false news need to be reformed. The global rights organization Article 19 says harassment, arbitrary arrests, and torture under Jammeh forced over 100 Gambian journalists to flee the country. The new government has taken steps to address impunity. In May, the Banjul Magistrates Court issued arrest warrants for two ex-soldiers suspected of murdering Deda Hidara, an editor of The Point, who was found shot dead in his car in 2004. The case of another local reporter, Ibrima Mane of the Daily Observer, remains unsolved. He disappeared in 2016. Rebuilding trust takes time.
We have changed, but still, there are people in the system who still believe that journalists are enemies. And this is something that really needs to change.
Freelance journalist Seni Marena recently returned to his home country after living in exile for 3 years. He took part in training hosted this month in Banjul for Gambian security forces on freedom of expression and journalist safety. The reporters sat at the same table as the officials they once feared. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Banjul.
In related news, the Gambian government has shut down the Daily Observer newspaper. The government says the paper owes thousands of dollars in back taxes. The paper is said to be owned by former ruler Yahya Jammeh, who is living in exile in Equatorial Guinea. The newspaper employs over 100 people.
Tunisia is extending its state of emergency for another 4 months. It was first imposed in November 2015 after a bombing in Tunis left 12 presidential guards dead. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for that attack, as well as earlier attacks at the Bardo National Museum and a beach resort that killed nearly 60 tourists and a museum guard. In other news on Tunisia, Reuters reports the World Bank has approved a $500 million loan to bolster the nation's budget. The government has struggled to fulfill its promises to create jobs and cut deficits.
Zambia's parliament has suspended 48 opposition lawmakers for boycotting a speech by the president earlier this year, a sign of mounting tensions as the jailed opposition leader awaits trial of a treason charge. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell reports.
For the next 30 days, the 48 opposition lawmakers will not be allowed to attend parliament and will not be paid. The move will stall many parliamentary committees that will no longer have a quorum, with 48 of the nation's 166 lawmakers out of commission. Politically, it will only further deepen the widening chasm between the increasingly entrenched ruling party and an increasingly angry opposition. On Tuesday, Parliament Speaker Patrick Matabini said the 48 members, all of them from the largest opposition party, had committed gross misconduct by boycotting the president's speech before Parliament in March. Opposition spokesman Charles Kakoma disagrees. He says Zambian lawmakers have frequently expressed their dissatisfaction by using similar tactics, with no consequences.
Under our constitution, the members of parliament enjoy freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And that expression includes remaining silent, or indeed walking out, or deciding not to attend the parliament as a way of protest. So they are within their constitutional rights to do so.
Zambia is in an ever-deepening political standoff that has been brewing for months. The trouble dates back to last year's election, in which opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema challenged President Edgar Lungu at the polls, and then challenged the legitimacy of Lungu's win. In April, Lungu's motorcade crossed paths with Hichilema's convoy on a country road in western Zambia. Hichilema's drivers refused to give way on the narrow road, prompting police to later raid his home, arrest him, and charge him with treason. Hichilema, who leads the United Party for National Development, has been jailed for more than 6 weeks on charges that rights groups say are politically motivated. His court appearances have been slow and often delayed, leading his supporters to cry foul. He remains in a high-security facility, Kakoma says, among convicted criminals who are awaiting the death sentence.
I visited him yesterday, and it is terrible. The condition in which he's being kept dehumanizing, the low standard for any human being to be kept there.
Kakoma said the party is still planning its response to the parliament member's suspension and will likely challenge it in court. 10 members of the United Party for National Development were not suspended as their absences had been excused before the speech. On Wednesday, Zambia's Conference of Catholic Bishops said the nation, which had been proud of its long and peaceful history, is slipping towards dictatorship. Rights groups like Amnesty International have also condemned recent events in Zambia, but representatives said Wednesday they are still researching the legality of the lawmaker's suspension. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenyan officials say two people have died following Monday's collapse of a condemned building in Nairobi. The deputy head of the National Disaster Management Unit, Pius Mwachi, says a woman who had been pulled from the rubble has died of her injuries at the hospital. He says the body of her son was found at the scene yesterday. However, the woman's two other children, a son and a daughter, were found alive. The Associated Press quotes Mwachi as saying one man is believed to be still trapped in the debris.
Campaigning is underway in Kenya for the much-anticipated August elections. For a preview of the top issues, Jill Craig visited the People's Parliament in Nairobi and has this report.
All of a sudden today,
they may not be making the laws, but they certainly have an opinion about them. On the sidewalk near Nairobi City Hall, you can find the Bungay Lawaza Lendo, or People's Parliament, meeting morning, noon, and night. This group is one of a few that meet in Nairobi's city center. They discuss a variety of important issues and, of course, the upcoming August elections.
Actually, we talk about the high cost of living, and we also talk about our top leadership. Yeah, we discuss almost everything around this area.
And the high cost of living is a big concern among Kenyan voters, says Gabriel Mayeye, chairman of the People's Parliament.
You cannot get water if you want to get water. You cannot get the ambulance for you to be in the hospital. You cannot get free health care. You cannot get food.
At the People's Parliament, the regulars take turns speaking. People walking by often stop and take the floor themselves. It is mostly men, but there are a few women. Margaret Ngani says she is fed up with corruption, and that will guide her vote for president in August.
Yes, we are going to vote this man out because he's a thief. He has stole from us. He's just taking us for a ride. He's not taking care of us, and we are taxpayers. We are paying taxes. Even if we are going without food, we are paying taxes.
But others support President Uhuru Kenyatta, often citing his infrastructure projects as proof of success.
He has done a good job and still have a very long journey to do to take Kenyans to the final part of the journey.
Other voters remain skeptical that either the ruling party or the opposition will bring positive change to the country. Stephen Owoko attempted to run as an independent candidate in the presidential elections before the Electoral Commission denied his application.
Oh, wow. I know, but for now, it's just a matter of saying, which one is a better devil? Which one is a better devil? When the time comes, I'll decide.
But there is one thing most Kenyans agree on.
By the way, politics is everything, because when you look at what is going on in this country, the most contributor of what is going on in this country is politics.
Kenya's elections are slated for August 8th, and the People's Parliament members will be watching closely. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The European Union is taking legal action against three member countries for failing to follow through on promises to take in refugees. AP reports European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker says the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland have not accepted any refugees for more than a year. A majority of EU nations had approved a two-year program to relocate and settle about 160,000 refugees. However, only about 20,000 were relocated shortly before the program ended last September. The Czech Republic, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia voted against the plan.
As the Earth's climate changes, Africa will experience increased drought desertification, flooding, and other extreme weather. African politicians are hoping for international aid money to help their nations adapt to rising temperatures. But getting aid may bring pressure from donors to put specific climate change policies in place. Bridget Sim is a public policy professor at the University of North Carolina. She told VOA's Adam Phillips that while lawmakers must respond to climate change by creating effective policies, they cannot do it by themselves.
One thing that I've been interested in looking at is the response of citizens. In most consolidating democracies or established democracies, of which there are an increasing number in Africa, voters need to support policies in order for them to be passed. Politicians are logical people who are not going to put forth policies and advocate for policies if they know that they won't be popular.
So the first question is, are climate change policies popular with African voters in democratic countries?
Here, I've done some research together with my co-author, Nick Obradovich, looking at the conditions under which voters might support climate change policy, primarily in Malawi. But then we did actually a follow-up study with voters across Africa. And what we found is that voters just don't support climate change policy. Or perhaps more accurately, that it's not as big of a priority as some of the other immediate needs that need to be addressed surrounding them. So when given a choice between a candidate that supports climate change policy or one that supports other different kinds of priorities, say housing, education, the economy, et cetera, they don't vote for the politician that supports climate change policy. And in fact, they actually decrease their support.
So this must put political candidates in a bind, because on the one hand, they want to get elected, they want to please the people, and they also need the international aid money and recognition that comes with the climate change policies that the international community wants to see happen.
Exactly. They face a lot of external pressure to respond to climate change and enact climate change policies, but they face a lot of internal pressure to basically do anything else.
Did any African politicians speak with you directly about their dilemma?
We were able to do interviews with a number of elected representatives in both South Africa and Malawi. And here's an example. A South African member of parliament said, "Voters are not concerned about climate change. They're only concerned with bread and butter issues that are affecting them on a daily basis." Another Malawian representative said, "We never talked about climate change in our campaign. You can't talk about climate change in an election here. Why would you?"
So how do they deal with this seemingly impossible choice between promoting international climate change policies and accepting the aid money versus being defeated at the ballot box, which no politician wants?
So what we see is that a lot of politicians will nominally support climate change policy, but perhaps that doesn't translate into actions that the voters can see. So they will maybe support the receipt of aid to go towards climate change policy, but then they will just simply not do a lot surrounding it, or at least they won't campaign on the issue because it's not popular with their people.
That answer sort of surprises me. I would have thought they'd quietly accept all that international aid money, but put it into projects that weren't really visible to the public, thereby risking angering the public. So they'd spend the money, but they'd do it in a way that wouldn't make them unpopular.
So that's one possibility. But what we do know is that in general, there's a huge danger with providing large grants of aid in that it can get diverted either through explicit corruption, where the funds intended for a certain purpose are explicitly just stolen by different politicians. But actually, the more common kind of corruption is this soft corruption, where it's just simply used in a slightly different way. So it's less about illegal activity, and it's more just about using the aid for political gain in a way that's perhaps not technically illegal, but it's also not as it was intended to be used, and perhaps not as efficient as it could be.
That was Professor Bridget Sim, a public policy researcher at the University of North Carolina. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
One-third of the world's population is considered overweight or obese. VOA's Jessica Berman reports the authors of a new report call the problem a growing and disturbing public health crisis.
2.2 billion children and adults worldwide, or 30% of all people, are affected by diseases connected to excess weight, according to researcher Christopher Murray, director of the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Results of the massive study were presented at the Eat Stockholm Food Forum meeting in Sweden and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The IHME evaluated health information from 195 countries and territories from 1980 through 2015. The prevalence of obesity, according to Murray, has doubled during the past 25 years in more than 70 countries and increased in most of the others. Murray says excess kilograms are causing more than 4 million deaths each year, 40% in people who are overweight but not technically considered obese.
The main contributors to death in terms of, you know, the causes are a big chunk is heart disease, particularly ischemic heart disease, but others as well. A number of different cancers that have been linked to overweight and obesity, and then diabetes and chronic kidney disease.
The data came from the Global Burden of Disease Study, a systematic scientific investigation to quantify the impact on society of all major diseases, injuries, and risk factors by age, sex, and population. In the United States, 79.4 million adults were considered overweight or obese in 2015. China followed with 57.3 million in sheer numbers of adults above a healthy weight. The country with the highest percentage of obese adults is Egypt, where 35% of the adult population is obese. The highest level of obesity among children and young adults was in the United States, at nearly 13% of the population. China has the most obese children, 15.3 million youngsters, and India is next with 14.4 million. Vietnam and Bangladesh had the lowest percentage of overweight and obese individuals overall, at just 1% of the population. Murray notes there's no single factor that's contributing to the increasing numbers of people with a weight problem.
The combination of, you know, less physical activity, more calories, you know, more carbohydrates, contributing to this trend that we're seeing that's quite global.
During the next decade, IHME researchers and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization plan on gathering and sharing the best evidence-based strategies to tackle the epidemic of obesity worldwide. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the challenges facing women and girls in Africa on their road to empowerment. We'll examine the current situation and look ahead at the way forward. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
VOAAfrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.